When and how did you first become interested in getting into radio?
I'll tell you. It was, I was in my mid-teens, going to McGee High School, Caresdale, good old black and red. And my best friend was a guy named Bob Hicks, who, sadly, about a year ago, died. My dad in those days was a businessman. He used to own the chain of stores called Forst's, which were all over the place. They're kind of like Wasks and all that stuff. And he used to add by the noon news on CKNW. And he would bring the commercials home because they'd give him copies to look over. They were on paper. And I thought, wow, this is cool. This is like looking at, you know, the Declaration of Independence or something. Look at this. It's on actual, you know, had a little top dog in the top. And, wow, it's really official. So Bob, my friend and I, we'd come home after school and we'd get these commercials. And we had a little old Sea Breeze tape recorder. So we thought we'd read these things into the tape recorder and see what they sounded like. And we thought, of course, they sounded wonderful. And then we figured, well, let's do a disc jockey show. So we'd take the little microphone and we'd hold it up to the radio when there was music playing. And then we'd bring it back and we'd eventually, of course, we'd run out of these commercials. We only had two a week or whatever it was, written by Tony Antonius. And I think, of course, that's another story. But so then we start to rip commercials, if you like, or advertisements out of the newspaper and use those also, and we read those things. And I got so into that, and so, or maybe my dad, I don't know, said, or maybe I asked him, how can I pursue this? Regardless, somehow, at the age of 15 or 16, he got me to get in touch with Hal Davis, who was the program director of CKNW, who was getting all this largesse from my father, and said, can you get Brian into the station doing anything? He's in school, you know. So and they were way out in New Westminster, and I was in Caresdale. But regardless, maybe I had a driver's license in those days. I don't know how I did it. I got out to New Westminster on weekends, but only at midnight. Because that's when their all-night guy, Jerry Davies, was on, and they were going to let me pick the records. He was having requests for 2 hours a night or something like that. So that's what I'd do. And I thought that was just great. And Jerry was just a great guy. He'd tell me, of course, how great he was. I was Vancouver's Frank Sinatra, you know. Yeah, is that right? And mind you, what do I know? I thought Jerry was just the king of radio. I used to say to him, why aren't you on in the daytime? You're so great, you know. Oh, I don't know, politics, he'd say, and all this kind of stuff. Mind you, he was good in his way. And a great-looking kind of dude, too. You could see why he would win these singing contests. And then I'd answer his phones, take the requests, and then I'd run and find the big records and take them into him, and he'd play them. And then once in a while, he would say, at like at 3 in the morning, do you want to read the news? And I'd say, oh, yeah! So, like, I'd read the news. So that's how it kind of began. And then somehow, I heard about this radio course that was going on in Vancouver while I was in high school. And it was for all the university students at UBC. They called it URTC or something? Mm-hmm. University Radio and Television, URTS, Society. Once a week, they would meet in the basement of either the Devonshire or the Georgia Hotel, I forget. And they would do a course down there, and it would be taught by Johnny Ansel, I think was program director at WX or manager or something or other. Great voice, little guy. Ain't it always the way? Little guys have the biggest voices. So he got me into there, and I was the only kid in there. But they graded us all at the end, and he gave me top marks, which I thought was good. And he was impressed by me. I said, can I come and work for you, Johnny? He said, no way. But he got me into Prince George because his boss was a guy named Tiny Elphick, who was the manager of WX. Tiny Elphick's brother, Sess Elphick, was running CKPG Prince George. So John asked Tiny, who asked Sess, if they could get me into Prince George. And that's where I began as soon as I got out of high school. Long answer to a short question.
And what were you doing in Prince George? What was your job up there?
It's pretty much everything, isn't it, usually?
Mm-hmm. First one?
I don't remember. I think I think it was morning, because there was a guy there named Jack Carbet, another little guy with a big voice, who drank big amounts of alcohol. And but he was a real character, this little old, he looked like he drank a lot of alcohol. And he wore these big, huge, brown, large suits on his little skinny frame. And he was doing the morning show, and he was the program director, and he was doing a lot of drinking, which took a lot of time, at the good old McDonald Hotel up there. And also, he was an organist. There was a guy who, very well known, maybe he's got more than one funeral parlor, I don't know, but Harold Assman was his name, and he ran funeral parlors. Sounds like a cartoon character. It's Assman. He ran a funeral parlor up there called Assman's Funeral Parlor, of all things. So whenever there was somebody dying, which was quite often at Prince George, Jack would play the organ. So that took a lot of his time, too. So he needed somebody to do the morning show. He wanted to get off, and therefore it was mine. And that's what I started off doing. That's quite a jump.
It
I
is.
Wish I could remember, because I can't imagine. Well, I think I was playing a few tunes. Jerry let me do a little bit of that at NW, you know, with Lester Lannon and cuts from My Fair Lady, you know, and all this good stuff. Song stylings of Matt Monroe. But that was where it was. It lasted only for 10 months because we kind of got, another friend of mine from Vancouver was also there, who shouldn't have been in radio. And we both got fired at the same time because we were doing too many silly things later. But that I got down to, that's when I got down to OR.
Okay.
It just was a nice happenstance that they needed somebody to fill in for the departure of Red Robinson out of there.
So what shift were you doing there at OR?
Where at OR? The one that Red used to do prior to his leaving, obviously, and I don't remember exactly what it was. It was afternoon.
I think it was afternoon.
Yeah. They Red was, he captured the market, the right place at the right time for dear old Red, and he discovered rock and roll, or it discovered him, or something like that. And he went to WX, and they wanted to see if they couldn't keep the kids there. And they couldn't figure out how to replace them, so they thought the best thing to do is to have a contest and lay it out there for teens to apply and to audition. And the guy who was doing all the organizing and everything was a youngish kind of guy, an Italian guy named Bruno Simolai, who was the newsman. And he was kind of filling in weekends for Red, and I think he filled in as Red left as well. And they phoned me because they had about 1,000 applicants, and none of them were any good because they had no radio experience. But they heard that this other guy who I was younger than most other 18-year-olds, I got out of school earlier, so I'm the same age as these applicants. So they said Vic Waters and Lloyd Hull, Dave Hull's dad, were the guys in charge down there at OR, and one of them phoned me, I forget which one it was, in Prince George, and said, we hear you're free, we're having a contest, you're going to win it, come on down here, and keep your mouth shut. So, I won!
Amazing.
Yeah. Maybe I won, I'd like to think I won from votes, although I don't know. Everybody was, of course, all the high schools were voting for their own people. But anyway, of course it was a disaster because you can't replace somebody who's established what Red had, and he took everybody away. So that didn't last for very long, mainly because I'm an introvert and Red is an extrovert, and kids in those days, I guess even today, like somebody who will get out there and do all that stuff that Red did and continues to do. And I prefer just the theater of the mind in the studio. Doing a little radio art kind of thing. You can tell that the business has, as I divert, the business has its extroverts and its introverts. The extroverts usually are better off the air, like the Rick Honeys and the Red Robinsons. They can go out on stage and just capture anybody. The other ones, just stay in the studio and kind of create pictures and all this kind of stuff. And then when you get them outside on stage, they just collapse, you know, because it's just very different types. You think everybody's the same, mm-hmm. but they're sure not. There's polar opposites in the business.
So how long did this little gig last at OR?
I can't recall whether it lasted more than a year. I doubt it. And they said, you can now do the six, that's it, it's finished. We're going to go another direction. But you don't have to leave. You can do the 6 o'clock news, which I thought was kind of funny. You know, that's the major news of the day in those days, 6
right.
o'clock at night. Not now, but it was then. They didn't have 6 o'clock news on television, I guess. That didn't last very long. They figured out, I don't think an 18-year-old has a lot of credibility at 6 o'clock. I wasn't really Tony Parsons. So that didn't last very long either, and I was canned. And that's the only time I've been out of radio, when I was working at Woodward's for a little while.
How long?
Waiting for something else to come up.
How long did that little episode take, the Woodward's episode?
I can't recall. It was well under a year, because
mm-hmm.
my father, being in a similar business, got me in there. I said, let me go into sporting goods. There's something cool like that. And he said, no, you won't get ahead. Radio is kind of silly anyway, wasn't it? We're going to get you into business now. And the only way to get into it is to start at the bottom, learning stock and that kind of stuff, and then you go up to be a manager. So they got me into the women's undergarments department. And I got a neat smock, and I had this thing that I'd push around. And I was learning the stock. I was learning the bras and the girdles and all that. And I go, oh, my God. And that lasted maybe a month, if that, before they realized this is not good. So they said, you're fired, so you can work off your time in the gas station. They had a gas station out behind, was it Cordova or Abbott or something like that? So I'm out there pumping gas, and they said, you're doing a good job. You can do this forever. So, but then they decided, no, he's not meant for this. That lasted a couple of months out there. We used to fool around with the customers too much, you know. I remember one lady came in, and she's running out of gas, and we asked her, we filled it up and said, do you want a little bit more in case the price goes up? Or she said, can you do that? We said, sure, we'll put it in your trunk. Oh, come on. But I do stupid little stories, but we'd do all this kind of junk and all these old chestnuts, and they'd get complaints, of course, in Woodward's that there's smart Alex working in the gas station, so I got fired out of there. But happily, Monty McFarland, remember him?
Mm-hmm.
He was working. How did that work? I think, I can't remember what happened. Oh, I think OR called me to, yeah, OR called me to go back and do their all-night show, which was like 12 till 6 in the morning.
Mm.
But it was super. It was just great, because you got no boss at that time of night. You can do whatever you want. It was the first real fun show, because prior to 12, I go down to the Cave Supper Club. And I'd see everybody down there, all the biggies in those days, like Satchmo and Ella and who did Raven? Something or other. Anyway, Marty Robbins, you know, and Guy Mitchell and all these guys. And I'd get them to come up to the show after or before mine and theirs, rather. And they would. They got nothing to lose, and we just, you know, I'd see them down at the club and say, can you come over after? And they would, and because they had nowhere to go, and they had to wind down. So that was great stuff. And then Monty would be going to work early at LG, which was in North Van. He'd listen to me, which I found out later. Very complimented by, because he was the king, I thought. Nobody listened, but he... when they needed to go, or they wanted to go rock and roll over there, Monty said to the guys who were trying to get it going, all these rock and roll experts like Lyndon Grove and Pat Burns, these were, and Al Pollard, they were all over there, Al Jazbo Collins or whatever his name was. Monty got them to hire me over there as they started their rock and roll business at LG. And that's how I got over there. That didn't last for, that was a farce. I can't remember who else was rocking those days in Vancouver. WX, I believe. Probably McCormick. Yeah, McCormick was doing his own show at C-Fun. Just that. I don't know what the rest of the day at CFUN was like. But that was just so silly at LG. It was so weird, so bad. Example, there was a guy, the Gibson brothers. There's a lot of Gibsons, you know, and one of them, Clark Gibson, I'm told, he was the guy who had the major share in LG in those days. Maybe he owned the whole thing. But we would have a top 10, and we'd play it over and over and over and over. They figured that's what we had to do. And one of the biggest records of all, I can't remember the name of it, he hated. He was listening. Clark Gibson and all his friends are in Point Grey beside their swimming pool, I was told. And they hated that number one record we kept playing every 10 minutes. So they said, take it off. So Al Jazbo, what's his name, or Lyndon Grove, came into the control room and said, we can't play that anymore. Clark doesn't like it. And I said, but it's number one. We're supposed to be a rock station. He said, well, in that case, play the other side. So we play the B side. I mean, that's just an example of how stupid it was. But that's when McCormick talked Jack Sayers, the manager of CFUN, into going rock all day long and giving WX a run. So he brought in me and maybe Al Jordan was still there and Brian Lord and a bunch of other guys. And we worked 16, 17 hours a day. And it didn't take us long to knock off Red and all his little American friends, which is the last time Red was really successful on radio. And that was way back then.
How did the Frosty thing come about? I knew that
happened. I don't know.
Was that given to you or did you come up with it?
I don't know. But I do know, I don't know when it began. I don't know, I don't think it began in the OR days.
I think it was McCormick.
Interesting little search one day. But I do know because the last name, everybody figures when you go to write it down, when you hear it, it would have an E in it. Forest. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't. It's just F-O-R-S-T. And that's always transposed. When I go to a restaurant now, if I'm waiting in the bar to go in, they'll always, Mr. Frost, your table is ready. It happens to me and all of my relatives, of course, except my Asian relatives. Mm-hmm. The only other thing about the Frost deal, therefore it got to be a nickname, but coincidentally, there was a big jock in King in Seattle named Frosty Fowler. And some folks thought I stole it from him. I really didn't. It was just a weird coincidence. But that was that anyway.
And it stuck.
It appears to have, yeah.
So how long were you there and what was your shift at CFUN?
Where? Oh, well, that whole thing lasted about 5 years, I think, roughly. For me, other people kind of came and went. And I think the shift changed. I believe Dave McCormick, a lot of people have better memories of old-time radio than I do. It might have started midday or afternoon or maybe early evening. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. But you were playing rock.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I remember coming down here in the summer of 64. I used to visit John Tanner at CFUN.
Jolly John.
Yeah, Jolly John, who's also on the list to be interviewed.
I was just talking to somebody yesterday or the day before who was over to have dinner with John, and he's the same. His wife is sweet and kind of helps him around. And this guy, I can't remember who I was talking to. They were thrilled because JB phoned, and John kind of winked at this guy that I'm trying to think of who it was I was talking to. And handed the phone over, and the guy freaked out when JB started talking to him on the phone. The good old days of JB Shane, Joel Adnikoff, and anyway, I interrupted.
No, that's fine. You put in your 5 years at CFUN.
Yeah, and radio kind of well, it's changed so much now. You can't really compare it to those days, but fads don't last, and that's what everything kind of was. And LG was the new guy. We were the new guy. That's why we knocked off WX.
But you were better.
Well, yeah, we were that too. Then LG started with Roy Hennessy and JB. I can't remember. I was. Yeah, who's the guy with the initials? Daryl Burlingham.
Daryl B.
Daryl came to CFUN first in '65.
Well, those were the guys who started playing rock. and therefore the kids kind of went there. That's the way it goes. We knew we were old. We knew, therefore, there's no way to turn the ship around. And at that time, radio buddies from the States who ran an organization called Cole Green, which was like an American chorus, if you like, in those days. We knew them from vacationing in Hawaii and exchanging ideas and stuff like that. They asked three of us to go to their stations. They asked McCormick to go to Fresno. They asked Lord to go to San Bernardino, and they asked me to go to Honolulu, where the big station was one called Ke Poi. Mm-hmm. That's the Hawaiian food.
Right.
And I'm the only one who didn't leave, mainly because I was kind of afraid, and also because my good old father, who thought everything was nuts in this business anyway.
And he was right.
Well, yeah. Although, yeah, well, he thought I'd go broke. He wasn't right about that. But he went broke, as it turned out. But anyway, he also pointed out the obvious, two things. Three. You can't stay in rock and roll forever. And what's going to happen, of course, when you're too old and you're sitting over there. Also, Hawaii is a great place to visit, but you wouldn't want to live there. Also, the Vietnam War is on and you'll get drafted. So all three pretty good reasons not to go. So I started scratching around. I think I'd heard there might be a vacancy at NW, but regardless, I figured, or maybe my father suggested, it's NW time. You're married now. I think I was getting married around then, too. And so I remember seeing Hal Davis's car down in South Granville. He was at the Stanley Theater or Primo Villanuevas or something, but I recognized his car, and I put a business card. We had the neatest business cards ever. You might have heard of these things called Paladin cards. My idea. Remember Paladin on television?
Mm-hmm.
Have gun, will travel. I think everybody today should get Paladin cards. They were great. It was Dave McCormick, C-Fun, was here. They were black, so nobody would throw them away. We'd place them everywhere. They'd be there like a year later, you know, because, wow. Anyway, I put one in Hal Davis's windshield, and I can't remember whether I added a note. We didn't know each other, of course. I might have said, have you got work or anything? Anyway, coincidentally, shortly thereafter, he phoned me. And we got together, and it turned out, Norm Groman was leaving. I think I'd heard that. He was leaving, he was doing afternoons or something like that over there, and he was leaving because he asked Bill Hughes for a five-day week, unheard of in radio, and Bill didn't respond. So Norm sent him another note saying, if I don't hear from you within a month, I'm leaving, thinking, of course, he'd hear from him, which he didn't. So Norm left. So there was that space, And that was a tough decision. Good old Dad was right this time again. He stepped in because I said, I'm like 25 or 26 years old, and these guys are dinosaurs. You know, you got Ed Ferry and Wally Garrett, and they don't have any teeth, you know, and they wear like white shirts with starched collars and wide ties, and hello, who are you? You know, this kind of stuff. So anyway, I don't want to go there, Dad. I'm a rock and roller. I can never fit in. But he talked me into it. He said, you're married, and, you know, yeah, that's where your future is. And he was right. As it turned out, I don't know whether it's me patting myself on the back, but I think I changed them because they had to accommodate, and I talked them into playing Elvis, you know. There was a guy in the library, this old fellow, Len Hopkins. Old fellow, lovely old man. He had a monkey in his house named Jigs, or maybe that was his wife. Not the monkey, but I forget whether Jigs was the monkey or the wife, but he had a wife, and he had a monkey. That was all I remember about Len. Anyway, I got him to play Elvis, and then we got into other stuff, and it was tough to do. Not that we became a rock and roll station, but they started experimenting with a few things and getting out of their
the ways they were stuck in, you know, for 20 and 30 years. So that was kind of cool. But what a heck of a move, because I don't know anybody who stays at one radio station for that length of time.
How long were you there exactly?
I don't know. From age 26 till age 65. How many years is that?
It's a long time. Math was never my strong suit.
Teddy knows everything. Get out your abacus. Well, that's easy. 36, 46, huh? 56, 66, 41 years.
And how many, how long was
it? How many raises did I get?
No, how many, we'll ask about that later. How long did you stay there before you got moved on to the morning show?
I don't remember. Not long. You think it was 8 years? Because it wasn't long after having joined them that, maybe a year max, that the biggest name in radio in those days, sorry Red, was Bob Hutton, who was the morning guy on the NW. And he was very corny, extremely cornball, which is great. That was his act, and he did it wonderfully. So he also told management when he was leaving, way ahead of time, at least 5 years ahead of time. And I think he chose, looking back, it seems odd, but I think he chose age 46 for some reason that he'd be leaving. So they were very smart. You can imagine with Bill Hughes and Hal Davis and these people, they knew what they were doing. NW was so successful. Not by accident, and so they wanted it to be as seamless as possible. So I had done mornings, of course, at LG. They remembered that. They figured that I might be Bob's fill-in. So when Bob would have holidays, I would do it, so the listeners would get used to it. And Bob's holidays got longer and longer, and then finally Bob didn't come back, and there I was, and it was a pretty seamless deal. And it really worked out well.
Now, in those days, were you doing your own operating on your own show? Because I always have done that.
But I don't think in those days they had operators either. I think everybody did their own. Operators was something that came later. I don't know why it ever came. It was just spending money.
And
well, I guess some people are bad operators. And also, the equipment got pretty involved later. Because originally, you know, the boards were just little things like a... like a Honda dashboard or something like that, but after you got out of these. Come to think of it, some of the stuff we used to do was pretty complicated. You know, instead of now, you just slide in a CD or whatever, or hit a computer. We used to have to take little spools of tape and whip them up on a machine and spin them and get ready to go. And that's the commercial, you know. So, as well as some commercials would be on records and this kind of thing. So it was. But I didn't do it because I wanted to give me the money instead of an operator, like it was part of the show. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't know when I wanted a commercial to come in, and I didn't know when I wanted a tune to start until you just sense it.
Mm-hmm. It's a performance.
Yeah, it's a timing thing. A timing is a much overlooked ingredient. How it has to work. I don't just mean hitting the cue on a song, but timing it right out to the news tone and stuff like that.
And this was all before timers and all this other stuff. Did it with a clock on the wall and the whole thing.
Oh, yeah. But not only radio types, but even listeners would never appreciate, nor should they maybe, how important timing is. Mm-hmm. Because it's very subtle.
Now, how did
but I think it worked.
Yeah, how did your show change over the years in the morning?
You'd have to ask Darwin about that. You know, I mean, how does anything... I think the word evolve is is that...
Because you had a great cast of characters.
Well, I never grew up. I mean, even today, you can tell by what I wear or what I... or my motorcycle or to whom I'm married and things of that nature... what I was doing at Dave Chesney's party the other day. So that helps, because then you're always in tune with what's going on. Mainly because I was of that age anyway. I was young in years. But then, whether it was because children in the house, or children I would marry, or that kind of thing, you're always tuned in to what people in their maybe early 20s to mid 30s at the latest are into. Mm-hmm. The theater of the mind thing, I was always, those guys who do theater of the mind, they usually kind of always unconsciously, subconsciously imagine or picture their target audience. Occasionally, I can remember when I was a real young guy, it was my mother. But after that, it was always some guy or girl going to university. I always saw that person on Marine Drive or University Way driving to school. And that's who I was talking to, no matter what age I was. Because even though the numbers on my age would change, I didn't change. Mm-hmm. So, but radio would change. This got old, and that, or something, just an example of, to show you what I'm talking about. It came much later, but again, it's an example. Sean Webster was one of the best traffic persons ever, and she continues to be very smart, very attractive, very good at what she does. But she had eventually a couple of children, and some of her chat went in other directions that weren't as current as another woman I'd heard, Jennifer Thompson, who just came over from a rock station. Jennifer was into nightclubs and into rock and roll and all that kind of crap. And it just struck me, it's time to change. And that's a hard thing to do. But that's an example, because it hurt Sean, but it helped the show. And that's what I had to do. The other changes were put on me, like it's a constant battle to keep stupid changes out. It's the old Peter principle in radio. I digress a lot, don't I?
No, go ahead.
The management is always nearly people who come up from sales. And when they become managers, which is a natural evolvement, then they figure, oh, I must be a good radio person. I'll now tell the guys on the radio what they should be doing. But they don't know, because they're salesmen. So that's half of the radio business. Half is performing. The other half is keeping all the doorknobs off your back. We should do news every 15 minutes, Frosty.
Mm-hmm,
no, we
that.
Shouldn't. But Toronto says we should. Well, yeah. I mean, that kind of thing. I forget where we were going, but we were talking about how
changes,
it's changed.
Yeah, how the evolution of the show.
The one thing that they did do, I don't know what, I guess it was the right thing to do looking back, was they told me I had to stop playing music. And I always felt that I had a pretty good ear for it. I mean, even now, I'm listening to all the current stuff. That's what I got on my CDs in the car. At age 72 nearly, I forget where I was going. They said, stop playing the music. I got them down. I said, can I play like maybe 2 an hour? Because they said, if I stop playing music, what am I going to do? Well, you can do news every 15 minutes. Mm. Well, no. So they gave me a bit of a budget, which I had to con out of them. It was really hard. And so I would line up people to come on, like Darren
Parkman.
Everybody was against that, but I was able, if I had a skill, it was to bring out the best in these people. It was kind of like the old Johnny Carson days. Everybody thought Johnny Carson was great. What he would do and what he would say he did was to bring out the best in the people that came on his show. So everybody would say, hey, isn't Johnny Carson great last night? Well, yeah, he was, but it was the fact that he had on Dave Letterman as a comedian, or this kind of, it wasn't, well, Johnny too, of course. But that's what I could. Darren, I didn't think was at the height he was when I was with him when he did other stuff. Then I brought on guys like Michael Smith from Victoria. And they said, well, he's just going to do the news. And I said, yeah, but I figured out, for instance, the guy also did a hell of a Don Cherry. So I would feed him lines, and he would do Don Cherry at the beginning, and it would be very funny. or at the end of a serious news thing, I'd flip him a question that only Don Cherry would answer, and he'd do it. So he was great. So I brought that out of him, and that's why it turned out to be entertaining. And what they thought was just going to be news crap. And then Vaughn Palmer, who's very dry, but I even managed to get him giggling. Phil Reimer, was he going to replace Norm Groman with Phil Reimer? Yes, it's in exactly the opposite direction. He's not funny. But we figured out we can make Phil a doofus. And he was happy being a doofus. And then he'd get on laughing jags, and that would be funny. You can imagine, he'd be laughing for like 2 minutes. Couldn't stop. And I could just picture the 35-year-old driving to university, laughing his ass off. Because Phil is laughing, and he can, you know, that kind
it's
of...
contagious.
That was the evolving. And then if one had to leave, you replace them. And eventually, I was happy to lose all the records because I found that we could bring these things in.
And it was very entertaining.
Well, I thought so, because there was many guys in the newsroom who were funny, and many who were not. Hello, Gord McDonald.
Oh.
So you could bring out little, you could let them show their lighter side as well without screwing up the credibility of the newscast. It was done in the right way.
We were talking about how your show evolved over the years, and I think we were talking about all the people that you added and brought in and brought out and made them personalities to go into your show.
And that was fun in that it's much maligned and unfairly. Tom Plasteris, after a little bit of work, allowed me to dictate or ask for and receive what I wanted on the show. Rather than have, not just that I don't want 15-minute newses and all that, but he allowed me to pick and choose not only the music, when that went away, then the characters that would come on. I mean, he would never have heard of Darren Parkman. He found out who he was later, of course. He would have known Michael Smith and Vaughn Palmer and all these other guys, Bob Robertson, Phil Reimer, names I'm forgetting, unfortunately. But all these contributors, Jimmy Hollywood, all these people. So Tom's only job was to find the money to pay these people. Sometimes there would be flack from management, like, why doesn't he have on the same guy? Let's put on Dave Rutherford was a good example. Dave Rutherford, because they wanted, Chorus wanted to promote their people. And Dave is the big shot in Alberta. So I finally said, I think we needed somebody, and I went along with it. I said, okay, I used to know Dave. He was in Vancouver. Let's try. And he's kind of like a Jack Webster, very controversial in Alberta. Let's give it a shot. I really like Doug. I like his brother. So we got Dave on, and I said to Dave at the beginning, we have to live. We can't just, you know, do your opinions, Dave. We have to bring a bit of personality out. Like what? And I said, well, let's just choose this. Let's do the obvious. You're in Alberta. Let's make you a redneck. I don't know. But so I would start doing redneck jokes, and he hated it, and he showed it. It was terrible. He would leave silence, And so if I would just say to Plasteris after a couple of weeks of that experiment, this is not working. This is not good. And he said, well, it's funny because Dave is saying the same thing. Dave wasn't enjoying it. But there's an example. So we got somebody else. But there's an example. Once in a while you go along with management, and invariably they're wrong. So Plasteris knew that he was in a corner. But I guess I'm just getting carried away on an example of what we're talking about here. Mm. So I would feel comfortable taking the total blame if it wasn't working. I would like to choose who does the sports. I don't take any pride in being the major person in having Al Davidson leave, because Al was the best in the business and a friend. The sports guy, great. But at the end, as we all do, he started losing it because he had medical problems. And I managed to get McRae, who is just this wild man doing weekends and part-time, to replace him. So that was my call, and it worked. And again, going back to the Sean Webster, Jen Thompson thing, mm-hmm. another example of the people that I was able, and the news people. There were some news people who were in charge of the news department throughout the years who might have been good organizers, but they were not with a lot of credibility, and I didn't think that. I thought when the silliness of me stopped, we should have a good, credible news. The news was always the backbone of every successful radio and television station. I don't know if that's the case anymore, but it certainly was for a long, long time. So we needed the most credible people reading the major newscasts. And I was able 75% of the time to successfully maneuver the best voices and credible news people onto the air. It was all part of the 2.5 hours I was there. So if anybody liked what Frosty was doing, it wasn't quite right. It's what everybody else was doing while I was on, including mm-hmm. the news department. So it's a good pat on the head, if you like, to have successful ratings, knowing that the whole thing was a creation as opposed to just you doing disc jockey stuff.
Right. I always likened that to you being the ringmaster, introducing all the other acts and tying them together and getting them to work together.
Were you in town when the only television commercial that I ever created was running for CKNW?
No.
I wonder if Wendland remembers that. We had money in those days, and we wanted to come up with a television commercial, they told me. So they hired a guy out of BCTV, now Global. His name was Bob Shear, an American draft dodger, very clever guy. And I knew Bob because I was doing the book up at BCTV then. And I said to Bob, I've got an idea. Would you just be the guy who helps me put it together? So he said, sure. So I wanted to go out to the game farm in Abbotsford on 264th out there. My idea was, because I'd been there already, they had this nut job monkey out there, or a chimp or whatever it was. And I was trying to feature an animal to match everybody on the air. Kathy Morse was a wonderful, feminine-sounding, graceful girl. Al Davidson was a big, heavy, big voice, rude, crude sports guy. Warren Barker, of course, was the guy who was the ringmaster of all the news people, and others who I forget. And my idea was I would, at the end of this commercial, we would get this monkey and we'd take a whole bunch of spools of tape and give them to the monkey and film the thing. And the monkey did what we wanted it to do. First of all, so we designed it so that the Frosty Four show, CKNW, blah, 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 was running. And then you'd say, Kathy Morris is our eye in the sky. I forget what order it went. The camera would start at the base of a giraffe and go up the neck, and the giraffe looked into the clouds so that Kathy could have been the giraffe or she could have been what the giraffe was looking at. Al Davidson drops in with, Big Al drops in with sports. So we had a hippo drop into a mud pit. And then Warren Barker runs the news. So the one that nobody got, I'm sure, they have out there a herd of news, GNUS.
Yes.
And somebody yelled, and all the news started running across the field, so we had that. And various others, I can't remember. And Frosty, he just ties it all together. At that point, you have the chimp, and he's already got these tapes, and he's trying to pull them all off the reels, and they're all going around his head and up his arms and everything like that. So that just came to mind because you said ringmaster, because that's all it was, just the person who tries to corral all of these talented people.
Yeah,
so that was kind of it in a nutshell, you know.
You had a great show. I mean, it was very entertaining. People tuned in and they stayed and they came back every day.
And it changed, I think.
It did evolve. Yeah, it did evolve. And then we come to 2005, which was the end of it.
Oh, yeah.
What prompted that? Was that your decision?
I think, you know what, looking back, I should have simply said, that's when I want to stop, because I really did not. There are a lot of people in television, hello Tony, who just keep going a little bit too long. And we can all name radio people who have passed their prime and just cannot stop. I don't know why they can't. Maybe it's unfair to guess, but I will. I think because they can't let go of the attention. It's addicting. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's for the money. In some cases, it's just them, and they can't stop it. I know that as my deadline was approaching, usually the radio host people start talking a year prior to the expiry of the contract. They leave it up to their contract people to talk to the radio station. And our radio station was not talking to my guy. And I would say to my guy, what do you hear? And he said, nothing. I leave messages. I'm not hearing anything. Which made me a little suspicious. What's this all about? So finally, our plan was, my financial guy and myself, to do another 2 years. I think I was 64, something like that. Do another 2 years and then stop. So I recall finally going into Tom Plisteris' office, which I was told not to do by my guy. He said, you stay out of it. But nothing was happening. So I'm a friend of Tom's. I just sat with him. I said, I'm not supposed to talk to you, Tom. But what's going on? I don't get why nobody's talking to anybody. And that's when he told me. He said, I've been talking to Toronto. I didn't know how to put this to you. I'm still trying to talk to them. And that's why nothing's happening, because it's like banging my head against the wall. This guy Hayes and Cassidy and all these guys, they want all the chorus stations to be the same, is what I'm told, which requires going in a news-ish direction. And I cannot get them to change their mind. However, I would like you to put your spin on it. And I said, well, I'd have to get rid of Parkman and quit jacking around. And he said, well, we'd like you to put, he said, you can, I said, you'd like me to talk to somebody in the parliament buildings and then get on somebody from the legislative assembly and do the murders of the day. And he said, yeah, but you could do it in your own way. So, and I thought, no. And to this day, I don't know whether Tom was hoping I'd say no. I really doubt that they would have paid me half of what they were paying me to host a thing like that. Mm-hmm. I think if I would have said, okay, I'll do that, then he'd say, well, there's one other thing. We're going to pay you one third of what you were getting. Then I thought, uh-oh. So it was like a punch in the stomach in a way, because there's a rejection of what I've been doing. But it wasn't really NW. It was corporate Toronto, who didn't get it. They didn't really know what NW was. They didn't care, which is okay. It's a business. They want to make money, and they want to spend as little as possible. That's the way the whole world is going. So I understand it. I get it. And then I went to my financial guy, because NW, these are papers you sign, but now the expiry is gone. They said, we'll see you, and here's $10,000. So I went to my guy, and he laughed. The fellow right now who's in charge of prosecuting Vassie and Burke in Victoria, he's an old schoolmate. His name is Bill Berardino. He's the one who got Al Davidson off from allegedly burning his boats down. He got Sparky off, and so you know he's a genius. Which is not saying anything about Al. So my guy talked to Berardino. That's all he did. He talked to him. And then he sent a letter to Cassidy in the East, and a copy did in Vancouver, to Lou Del Gabo, saying something about, we have talked to Berardino QC about this, and we'll see you in court, kind of deal. Well, what happens was they finally gave me what I would have been earning for the next 2 years, which still I kind of thought, oh, yeah, but I wanted to work, you know. And my guy explained to me, would you like a 2-year holiday at that salary, or would you like to work for that salary? And I thought, well, when you put it that way, that's a pretty good choice, you know. So
Let's end this on a high note. I want to know.
You're firing me?
No.
I'll sue you.
I think we've already fired you, haven't we?
Well, you're
or you've been fired. I was fired shortly after you were.
How many times were you fired?
Oh, let's see. I was fired in Lethbridge against the general manager's wishes, who was in Hawaii, and he tried to hire me back when he came back from Hawaii.
No,
and I'd already gone to CKXL, so it didn't matter.
No excuses. Now, just how many
fired
times?
Half a dozen.
No, twice.
Oh. I would say five or six. Anyway.
All right. To finish this off, can you tell me a personal highlight? What was probably the most memorable thing in your broadcasting career?
Well,
what stands out?
The beginning and the end stand out. Getting hired and getting... I won't say fired as being too mean on myself, but it was... Because it wasn't really a firing, but it was like that, because I left before I thought I was going to. Let's put it that way. And that was what you hear. It was a good kick in the stomach. And that isn't probably what you're talking about, but it's a feeling that I had heard about, and everybody who has had a girlfriend or boyfriend drop them, or have been fired, knows what that's, or had a loved one die, they know what that feeling is, and that's it, whoa. And it, but after about 3 days, it goes away. That's memorable. Other than that, there isn't one memorable thing. There's, you know, hundreds, and that's what is kind of cool about it.
How about some of the...
Certainly the people you meet.
That's what I was going to
absolutely
ask you, your favorite people, some
of
them.
Oh, man. I don't know.
Well, you mentioned
already. I'll tell you who... the majority of the favorite people, and I don't see a lot of radio, well, I guess I do, the majority of the radio people that are my favorite people are not air people. I can't think of any air people with whom I am, well, yes, I can. Of whom? Yeah, I'm sorry, there are two. But they're old-timers, Dave McCormick and Brian Lord. But other than that, I'm not friendly with any. All of my favorite people are those who are in the business but behind the scenes, from news to production and or promotion. Usually they're funnier than the so-called funny air people. The funniest and most talented people are very often not on the air. It's so unusual that that's the case. In our old NW building... Ted Wendland, a guy named Kenny Harris. I can't think of them offhand as we're sitting here. I've had too much sandwich, but are very funny, very amusing types. Another one from the old television days over at BCTV, there was a guy named Steve Busick, who's one of the funniest guys I ever met. He was never on, and these are off-the-air people who just like being in the business. Mm-hmm. And they're more down-to-earth. They're not all hung up on the ego trip that so many air people are on. And that's what's nice about them. They can get over themselves, which is what air people usually cannot. Mm-hmm. And that's why these are the people that I appreciate having met and still am trying to maintain a friendship with.
Mm-hmm. One last question, and I ask everybody this, who's been in the business as long as we have. Listen to any radio anymore?
Yeah. I only listen to 1040, the sports station. I was talking to somebody the other day about the golden days of radio, and I think that we're so lucky, when I say we, I guess mainly I'm talking about me, to have been there at the very beginning of what was going on and the end. If there's one, maybe if there is a God, and I don't think so, he or she helped me to know when it ended. Actually, it ended 2 or 3 years before I left, but that was the end of the golden years of radio, when they brought in talented people and gathered them up, and if they weren't with us, they'd hire them from somewhere else and put them all together and all that kind of stuff. That was, I forgot what your question was.
What stations were you listening to these?
Oh, sorry. The golden days of radio still kind of exist on 1040, which is the station I'm listening to, because they're trying something new, and they're the only ones doing it, and they pretty much got free will, it seems to me, to do whatever they want. It doesn't sound to me like one of their bigger stars, Dave Pratt, is probably a terribly likable guy off the air, but on the air, what an entertainer. and Don Taylor and these guys, that is really unique, and that's why I like them more for the what's going on other than the scores. That, and the only place to go for news, as far as I'm concerned, is WX, because it's like an old rock and roll station. It's on every 10 minutes, and the traffic is on when I want to hear it, and so those are the only two stations that I listen to, frankly.
Frosty?
Yeah. Brian?
Brian.
Edward?
Edward. Whichever of the three you prefer. I know it's Brian. So thank you very much for your time. This has been very enlightening.
Well, the pleasure's been yours.